I've been advised that this house all has been painted, so you might, some of you, who said that you can also smell some bit of irritation paint. So forgive us for that. The idea was not to punish you coming in. It just happened to be a coincidence. So we are looking forward to your presentation as the legal aid board to the committee. I'm Ramat Khali, which is my name. And my colleagues are here. I don't know how we go about it. Do we introduce ourselves, all of us, maybe? Or we don't do that. Details. I'll start with the committee members. So that's Ugungubele, it's my week. Mondri, let's just go ahead. Mondri.
Mondri Kungubele, member of the portfolio committee, WIP.
Ishmael Malale, member of the committee.
John Jeffrey, member of the committee. I don't know, Chair, whether we are forgetting our parties. ANC.
It doesn't matter. If you are proud of your party, you can say so.
Okay, obviously, Monty is not proud.
We are not compelled to disclose. I'm sure other people will join us later on. So we're going to start this side with the members of the legal aid. Yeah, thank you. We'll start with you, Matt.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. Thank you very much for inviting us. Thank you for giving us this slot. We've been waiting anxiously to come and interact with the committee because we come to report on what we are doing, but we also look forward to insights from the committee members, and to getting guidance on where we might improve what we're doing. So I'll do the introductions of my team. I'll start on my right hand here. This is Ms. Vidu Vedelankar. She's the Chief Executive Officer of the Legal Aid Board. She's in charge of the operations of the organizations nationally. On my right hand side is Mr. Peter Durant. He is a board member. He is a board member in the place of the Director General, who is the board member, but Mr. Durant attends the meetings of the board. Next to him is Mr. Jerry Makokwane. He is the Chief of Operations of the Legal Aid Board. Next to him is Mr. Mutsamai Magume. He is a board member, a practicing attorney, and he is the chair of the Legal Services Committee of the Board. That's the committee that oversees the legal services delivery component of the organization. Next to him is Ms. Sita Colby. She's a practicing advocate. She's a board member. And then next to her, we've got Mr. Brian Naya. He is the National Operations Executive. He is the man in charge of the legal services component of the organization. Next to him is Ms. Rebecca Slabatau. She's the person who is in charge of our finances, the Chief Finance Officer of the Legal Aid Board. Next to her is Mr. Patrick Handermark. He's from the Eastern Cape. They gave him a name as a Legal Aid Board practitioner there, the name of Vuli Dobo. Those who understand the language will know what that means. He is a legal development executive of the Legal Aid Board. Next to him is Ms. Cordelia Robertson. She is the regional operations executive of the Legal Aid Board. She is in charge of the Western Cape and the Northern Cape. Next to her is Mr. Vincent Maisela. He is also a regional operations executive. He's in charge of the Free State and Northwest region of the Legal Aid Board. And next to him is Mr. Gobus Esther Eisen. He is the Justice Center Executive of the Cape Town Office of the Legal Aid Board. That's the team. Mr. Mpho Pasha, he's the Communications Executive. He's just busy outside bringing some information packs for the court. I think he'll join us soon. Thank you, Chair. Those are the people who've come with me to make this presentation.
Thank you very much. we have just been joined by Ngosi from part of our committee here. Gentlemen who have just come in there. So we will then invite you to go ahead and start with the presentation.
Thank you, Chair. We've sent our presentation beforehand. I hope you got it in good time, and members of the committee. We're going to be speaking to the same document. I'll do part of the presentation, and the Chief Executive Officer will also do part of the presentation. If I could then start, Chair, the presentation is divided into parts, as you have seen in the content page. So I'll be following that index, if you may want to call it. The first part I want to deal with, Chair, is the mandate of the Legal Aid Board. Where does it come from? And we've set out in our pack that it comes from the Constitution, which is the...
My apologies, Honorable Ngubele. We do have some bit of technical
problems. Yeah. We plead not guilty to that.
Thank you. The plea is noted. Thank you. Yeah, let's go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Mpho Pasha, who I mentioned, has just joined us. He's the Communications Executive. Thank you. I was dealing with our mandate. It comes from the Constitution. We cited three sections of the Constitution, the main one being Section 35(3), which deals with the rights of accused persons and their right to have access to state-provided legal representation when they don't have it. And we also cite the Legal Aid Act, which is the act that establishes the Legal Aid Board, and that's the act in terms of which we do almost everything. And then our mandate also comes from other legislation. We've not set it out there. We'll deal with some aspect called unfunded mandate later in the presentation, where the Legal Aid Board is instructed in terms of legislation to provide legal representation. An example is the Mental Health Act. You have provisions in the Criminal Procedure Act. You've got the so-called PI legislation, which also contains provisions which expect us to provide legal representation. We also have some court orders from courts, especially the High Court, where we are ordered to provide legal representation. In terms of the Legal Aid Act itself, it is the act that sets the statutory framework for how legal aid is to be provided in South Africa. It is an act that is 40 years old, and we have initiated a process with the Department of Justice to redraft a new act that complies with the Constitution. That process is in place. And then we have a document called the Legal Aid Guide. It's a document that we launched a few weeks ago, which the Deputy Minister attended. I call it the Legal Aid Bible. It is a document that sets out all the details of the legal aid scheme that applies in South Africa. I then go on to the next session, Chair, and deal with the historical challenges that we came from. In the pre-2000 era, those who practiced law then would know that the Legal Aid Act, the Legal Aid Board provided legal representation through judicare. That's where we briefed lawyers and advocates in private practice and paid them. the case. It was found not to be a cost-effective way of providing legal services. And then the pre-2000 era was signified by management and administration systems that were not geared to ensure effective and efficient functioning of the organization. And I may sum up by saying in the pre-2000 era, the Legal Aid Board was in a state of collapse, and at some stage questions were raised whether the organization should not be shut down and something new be established. But fortunately, that didn't happen. I think the portfolio committee of the time supported a motivation that the organization be given a chance. Then when we deal with the post-2000 era, we had changed the delivery system to a more sustainable model, able to reach many more South Africans. That's when we introduced what we call the Justice Center model, where we use our own lawyers who are in full-time employment. We also introduced management and administration systems that were geared to ensure effective and functioning of the Legal Aid Board, and that's still the case. And I say here confidently that the Legal Aid Board has become a high-performance organization that is able to deliver on its mandate. I then deal with our staffing, how the Legal Aid Board is staffed, Chair, and members of the committee. Our staffing, if you look at the slide there, from 2000 to 2001 up to date, has increased from where we had about 326 employees to where we have over 2,000 employees. And then when we look at the infrastructure of the Legal Aid Board, we only had 8 offices in 2001 financial year. We're sitting where we have 62 justice centers. We also have what we call satellite offices. Those are smaller offices that are linked to justice centers. And then we have high court units. These are units of mostly advocates who are situated in justice centers that serve high courts. That's why we call them high court units. And then we've got regional offices which oversee the work of the Legal Aid Board in the regions. Like I mentioned, we've got 2 regional operations executives who are in charge of 2 of those regions. Then I go to the finances of the Legal Aid Board, just from a historical point of view. The budget has increased from 2000-2001 to from 332,000 to, in the past financial year that has ended, to 903 million South African rand. I can say that the jump from 651 million to 903 was the impact of OSD when it was implemented. That's why the budget jumped that much. And then I go into the next slide to dealing with the number of cases that we've done over the years. I think the slide shows it, that there's been a steady increase over the years. In the past financial year, we took on 434,000 and more new cases. I think that's testimony of how the Legal Aid Board has responded and using its resources to provide more legal representation to people who need it. Chair, I then go on to our strategy, the strategic plan 2009-2012. In doing that strategic document, we made sure that we align it to the government's medium-term strategic framework, 2009-2014, and I've set it out there what that strategic framework of the government requires, and we've aligned our strategic plan in terms of that. What I may highlight is, which is relevant for us in point 1.1.3, is that there is a review that's called and to determine human capital requirements for specific occupational categories, and we've made a point there that the number of prosecutors and legal aid practitioners has increased by 5%. In formulating our strategic plan, Chair and members of the committee, we identified a number of risks, strategic risks, that we had to be mindful of, and we've set them out. We've identified 13 of them. I may highlight that one of the risks that has continued to dog us is the one I said under the client and community point, which deals with the legal aid board image and reputation. It is unfortunate, Chair, that despite the good work we've done over the years, a perception of sorts still exists, influenced by the dysfunctional legal aid board of old. So everyone who talks about us simply thinks of us, of the legal aid board of old, but it's a perception that I have fought hard to dispel. It is dying, but it is still there. We've identified it as a risk. Another risk that we've sort of identified is under the government and parliament sector in number 9, political support for legal aid. I say this, Chair, based on my experience in traveling in the developing world in particular. I think South Africa has been called in other parts as a country that punches above its weight when it comes to legal aid. The South African government has shown maturity that one never sees in the developing world in terms of how it supports a legal aid scheme in this country. Everywhere we go, what the South African government is doing is not happening elsewhere. So I'm just saying it is a good thing that we have a government that is supportive of this scheme because it is mindful of the needs of the poor and vulnerable people. Another risk that I've identified is under the finance and sustainability point, Chair, that relates to the unequal resourcing of legal aid relative to other agencies, which impacts on the legal aid board performance and quality. If I may explain this, the legal aid board provides not less than 45% of all the work that happens in the district courts. That's where most of the criminal work happens in South Africa. In the regional courts, we provide not less than 80% of the defenses in those courts. And in the high courts, we provide somewhere between 90 and 95% of all the criminal defenses in South Africa. But when you look at the funding that we get as an organization, compared to probably the NPA, you'd find that those stats as to what our input is are not factored into how we receive our funding. So we're mentioning it as a strategic risk. The others, Chair, I've mentioned them there. And then going on with our strategic plan, in the next slide, I deal with the vision that we've crafted and our mission. Our vision is simply a just South Africa in which the rights enshrined in the Constitution are protected and defended to ensure peace and justice for all. We have a mission there. And then we've identified a number of values, 6 values all in all, that are there, that are in line with our vision and mission. And then going on, we then identified 4 outcomes in terms of our strategic initiative. The outcomes are set out there. The first one, an effective and efficient justice sector, as is realizable within our mandate, and the others follow on there, I won't read them. After we've come out with those outcomes, Chair, which we think were realistic, we then identified objectives. The objectives are set out in the slide there, and they are all grouped under specific sectors. We've got some under the client and community, some under the legal and justice stakeholder and shareholder. And we want to believe that they are all relevant and in line with what the government own medium-term strategic framework requires. And then I continue with the objectives in the next slide, Chair. We've got more under different headings, as you've seen there, under finance and sustainability objectives. We've got one objective that says we need to have a sustainable and financially stable legal aid board, which includes proportionate funding, funding for new legislation and new programs. There's a lot of them. I'm not going to waste time in going through them. And then, Chair, those two, the outcomes and the objectives, we then looked at them and formulated our strategies. We formulated 17 strategies. We adopted the balanced scorecard approach in formulating our strategies. And the slide sets out those four components of the balanced scorecard. Under the client, community, stakeholder, and shareholder objectives, we've got our strategies there, and I think I can just highlight one, which is to contribute to building an efficient and effective justice system and JCPS cluster, and to implement the actions emanating from the criminal justice sector review. And under finance and sustainability objectives, we've got a strategy to maintain a sustainable and financially stable legal aid board. And under internal business processes and objectives, we've got a strategy to ensure sound financial management and sustainable business processes. And under the employee and organizational capacity, innovation, and learning objectives, we've got one of the strategies, which is to support the development of functional legal aid systems in Africa and in the developing countries. I flag that one specifically, Chair, to inform the committee that the work that the Legal Aid Board of South Africa has done has not gone unnoticed. We have hosted countless delegations from other countries, from this continent and from beyond the continent, who've come to us, who've come to look at our model, and who've also invited us to their own countries to guide them in setting up their own legal aid systems. So we've identified that as a strategy. And then in the next slide, Chair, it's just a slide that shows how all the strategies that we've crafted, they are interlinked to each other in terms of the balanced scorecard approach. And then in the other slide, Chair, I'm just sharing information that the strategic plan 2009-2012 was submitted in terms of the regulatory framework to our executive authority, that is the Minister, on the 30th of September 2008. And once we finalized our strategic plan, we then prepared our business plan. And then that business plan expands the strategies into programs and projects. We have also identified targets and measures called key performance indicators for each of the programs and projects, and we have linked them to budgets and responsible people, as well as timeframes and milestones for delivery. And we also make sure that the individual performance contracts for all our staff, we have a performance incentive scheme, is linked to the strategic plan, boiled down up to that. Chair, that will be my introductory part of the presentation. With your permission, can I hand over to the CEO just to go on into some of the operational aspects of the organization? Thank you, Chair.
Good morning, Chairperson and members of the committee. As our Chairperson, Judge Mlambo, explained, we are reporting on our performance in terms of the four components of our strategic plan and the four components of the balanced scorecard. So we start with the client and community component, and in that we're looking at where are we at in terms of increasing access to justice in the current period. So if we look at the client and community component, slide 27 on your document pack, and it's also on the screen. We have a national footprint, which means reach across the country in all our provinces, and in terms of that, we have 62 justice centers and 55 satellite offices. By this year, we will have a presence at about 130 sites in the country, and we think that is a good start, but it actually doesn't reach every community that we need to. In terms of the staffing, as you can see across the provinces, we have staff, and what we also show is the legal staff, and that's quite important. That what was mentioned earlier was that we shifted to a system whereby we deliver legal services through our in-house lawyers rather than through Judicare, which is outsourced to private practitioners, and that means that we have over 1,500 lawyers employed by Legal Aid South Africa who then provide legal services to our clients. And what is also important is that we have a very high level of recruitment, and our recruitment sits at about 94%, which allows us to actually reach the people we need to. That map on page 29 actually provides the round circles, green ones, they indicate where our justice centers are located, and then the satellite offices are shown by the green triangles, and then there are also planned satellite offices shown by the red ones. So that is that indicates that. On that, we also have some document packs, further document packs for members of the committee, and the details of all our offices are provided in those so that you could use that in terms of the work that you yourselves are involved in. And those will be given out later. In terms of delivery, we are providing legal services in all the courts across the country. As far as the criminal courts are concerned, we have coverage of all the courts. And that then allows government, through the Legal Aid South Africa, to fulfill its obligations in terms of Section 35 of the Constitution, which is to provide assistance in criminal matters where if people can't provide it themselves, in the way there would be substantial injustice. So in terms of the spread of matters, you can see that the number of matters that we are doing in terms of new matters and finalized matters in each of the court type varies, and as would be expected and as is the case in terms of the number of matters handled in each court, that the bulk of those matters are in district, but we're also doing a fair number. In terms of the percentage of the trial the matters that go to trial in each court, it varies in district courts between 50 and 60% to in high courts we're providing legal assistance in about 70 to 80% of trial matters in high courts. In terms of the types of matters we do other than criminal, we're also doing civil matters. That means providing assistance in civil legal aid. And as you can see, that of the 434,000 matters that we did in the last financial year, 30,000 of those, which is just less than 10%, were in civil. Now, we don't think that that's adequate, but I think within the resources that we have, that's what we have tried to deliver, and that is one of the areas that we will identify as a challenge. And in terms of the criminal matters, we in this last financial year, ending March of 2009, we provided assistance in 404,000 matters, which we think is actually quite significant now. And in terms of the way in which we deliver that, you can see that we using justice centers, which is our own lawyers on the left-hand column, and we're also providing that assistance through Judicare to a limited extent because we retain a mixed system of delivery, and there it's only 32,000 matters. And then cooperation agreements are where we work with other non-government organizations and law clinics, et cetera, and also provide and increase access to areas that we ourselves wouldn't be able to reach. So the criminal-civil split, you can see, that shows you in that pie chart that it's actually quite a small number of matters we're doing in civil. The number of children we have assisted in the past financial year in criminal and civil, and you would note that in Section 28 of the Constitution, there's a specific requirement for us to assist with children in civil matters also, that you have... we have done assisted in 45,000 matters in the past financial year. We also increased our capacity to provide general legal advice so that we could assist people who didn't necessarily get to a court level, but a court stage, but just needed some assistance in terms of various issues. And we employ paralegals at all our offices to do that. And in the last financial year, we gave advice in over 100,000 matters. The impact of some of our interventions has also assisted in the way in which the courts operate and the number of people that are assisted, but especially important for us was this area of automatic reviews, and we reduced that, we contributed to reducing that from 30,000 in the financial year 2002-2003 to currently where they are just about 10,000, and we're constantly monitoring that and ensuring that especially from the point of view of reducing the number of unrepresented accused in courts, so which then could also result in these automatic reviews, that we have reduced those numbers so that it helps in improving this figure. In terms of the legal services we provide, we also very careful in tracking quality so that we provide a quality service, and we employ different categories of legal practitioners. Candidate attorneys are people who have got their legal degree and are serving articles with us. And then those who have passed their board exams are professional assistants, PAs. And then we have also PAs in our high court units. And we set targets in terms of quality, and we monitor that, and we can see that we are achieving the targets. In a later section on internal business processes, I will just give you indicate to you what kind of quality interventions we make and how do we monitor quality also. An important part of our work also is to reach out to the community so that they are aware of their rights issues, but also their aware of legal aid services. So through the process of getting them to understand what legal aid services we provide, we're also increasing awareness of the rights as per our constitution. And these are the range of projects that we have, from school interventions, community events, to branding of police and prisons, to branding in courts, and then also distributing material, and importantly, radio campaigns through the African language stations so that we can reach our client community. What we have also is a single national access telephone line, which is indicated in green, so that wherever a person is in the country, if they link that, if they call that number, one number, it will link them to our nearest justice center. So then what are the challenges in terms of legal delivery and this component of reaching our clients and community? The first is we have a low practitioner per court ratio, which means that the number of practitioners we have for every courtroom in the country is not adequate to meet the demands. We have improved it, and as you saw that as the funding increased, the staffing increased, and we have improved it, but there are still gaps. And then there's also that even though we might reach every courtroom, the reality is that the caseloads are still high for our practitioners, and that also impacts on them, but also on the quality, which we then monitor and track. Access to Legal Aid South Africa by clients in rural areas is also difficult, and as I said, with 130 sites that we are at, it doesn't reach all the people, and therefore we have to look at ways in which they could access us. Limited capacity to render civil legal aid services, then sustainability issues with community advice offices which impact on the demand. So we also had community advice offices that provided the first level advice in many communities, and as those were closing down, they impacted on the number of people who were needing direct services directly from us. Where they do exist, we also have a project which we are trying to grow even more, where we link with those advice offices. And what we do is we provide information to them, but also we send our lawyers who are assisting with civil legal aid matters to those advice offices on a planned basis, so that when they need to go beyond advice to actual legal assistance, then on specific days our lawyers could provide that service. A further challenge is the difficulty in accessing clients for consultations because of various reasons. It could be because of the being able to access them in the prisons and being able to consult with them, but also those that are on bail and not available. And so that becomes a bit of a challenge. And then the issue of quality is a challenge in that anybody providing a service on an ongoing basis must monitor their quality. So whereas we have put in place many measures to monitor quality, and we think that within our resources and with the, we have built our skills base over these past years, we are constantly mindful of the fact that we need to address quality. If we can look at the second part of the client and community component, it looks at stakeholders and the shareholder, and in this case, this is a government entity, as we explained earlier, so the shareholder is only government. And this, especially because this section is where the accounting authority for the Legal Aid South Africa is the board, the chairperson will actually take us through these slides to explain how that link between us as Legal Aid South Africa and the board in particular and government happens.
Thank you, Chair. I think as the CEO has indicated, we are a Section Schedule 3A entity, and in terms of the PSMA, we have to report to the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development, who is our executive authority, and we do that. We submit the following documents to our executive authority, the annual budget, as well as our medium-term expenditure framework, which looks forward 3 years at a time. And then we also provide quarterly reports on the progress of our work. We've always provided this. And then there are other requirements like strategic plans and other documents. In the past, we were asked to formulate a case for legal aid in South Africa in the next 20 years, and we submitted those research documents to the minister. And they are available for this committee should they have an interest in looking at those documents. And we also submit the following documents to our minister, but also to Parliament and this committee: the audited financial statements, the annual report on our performance, as well as the legal aid guide. Just for those who haven't seen it, this is how a legal aid guide looks. It will form part of the text that we'll be handing over to the committee. As I mentioned earlier, the Legal Aid Act, as it currently exists, was promulgated in 1969. It's an old act. There's a process of redrafting it, and it is quite advanced. We hope that it will be considered by Parliament next year. And then continuing with our stakeholder and client community component in terms of increasing access to justice, we've got projects that are aligned to the national and provincial forums that happened in the Justice Cluster, Chair. And I've set out in that slide, we've set out in that slide what the outputs that we're looking for are and what the target outcomes are. I mean, it is important for us as a legal aid board that we should have a very good stakeholder relationships because we should remain relevant at all times. We've got websites, we've got stakeholder events that we attend and co-partner with other stakeholders. Moving on to the justice cluster per se, we participate at national, regional, and local level in a number of justice cluster initiatives. They are set out in that slide, like we're part of the legal services charter process. We are part of the criminal justice system review. We are part of a number of other processes like the case backlog committee. We actually do receive funds to attend to backlogs in the case in the court. So those are all the interventions that we are involved in. And then going on to our finance and sustainability situation, Chair. In the next slide, I've summarized what our MTEF outlook is from 2010 to 2013. If you look at this current financial year, 2009-2010, our budget stands at 946 million, and the projections are there that in 2012-2013, we're looking at over a billion rands coming to the legal report. And as I said, I think this is good maturity. That's setting an example internationally. And then in terms of identifying MTEF priorities, Chair, we've also made additional funding proposals in line with that MTEF proposal for 2010-13. And we're looking at increasing our practitioners and civil capacity to make sure that we stop turning people away, those who want to access our services for civil legal aid in particular, as the CEO has mentioned, which is a challenge. And then going on to the next slide, Chair, the budget for 2009-2010 is set out in the next slide. In the last financial year, the budget was just over 900 million, and as I said, this year it's 946 million and above. And then looking at our annual financial statements, Chair, looking at our assets in particular, the slide there sets out what our non-current assets were in the past financial year and in the other financial year 2 years ago, as well as the total assets. We also set in the next slide our revenue streams in terms of our annual financial statements in the financial year that has just ended and the one before that. Those figures are in the document. I'm not going to go through them. And then in the next slide, I deal with our cash flow statement for the year that ended 31 March this year. can see that the cash and cash equivalents at the end of the year were just over 230 million. And then we look at our expenditure levels in the next slide, which tells you how much of our budget goes to salaries and to direct expenditure, operating expenditure, and what the totals are. That's all in the slide, Chair. We set this out for the committee to have an idea of what we do with the monies that come to us. And then there's a graph in the next slide that just deals with how the different components of the budget are spent. As you can see, you've got the budget and the expenditure for the 2008 and 2009 financial year, our expenditure levels. And then in the next slide, we just deal with an overview of how we've performed financially in the 2008-2009 financial year. We've spent over 99% of our budget. We have no under expenditure. We have provided efficient management of all our fixed assets and vehicle fleet management. As you know, we've got 130 sites, as the CEO said, so we've got quite a huge fleet of vehicles that ensure that our lawyers are able to access courts and those who are in the satellite offices are in court timeously. We've got the functional and efficient supply chain management committees that's in place. And we've flagged out there that 97% of Judicare accounts were paid within 30 days of receipt of invoice. I mention this because in the Legal Aid Board of old, this is one component that nearly brought the Legal Aid Board down, because people spent long times without receiving payment for their fees, and the contingent liability that arose out of the dysfunctionality then at some stage was estimated to be over $1 billion. We no longer have those problems, Chair. So that's just an overview of how we've performed financially. And then we come to how we account and for the monies we use. The Auditor General comes and audits our books, and we have, for the 8th year running, got an unqualified audit report. And this is the 4th year in succession where in that report there are no matters of emphasis. I think that shows that we've really done well as an organization in terms of looking after the money that government gives to us. And then in the other slide, I deal with how the Legal Aid Board of Directors is composed, Chair. I think this is important. Globally, the Legal Aid Board consists of 18 board members. That's in terms of the Legal Aid Act. 6 of those board members are appointed by the minister. 2 are ex officio. That's the Director General of Justice, represented by Mr. Durant, and the State Attorney of South Africa. And then you have 6 members of the 18-member board appointed by the State President of the country, in consultation with Cabinet. That's how the Legal Aid Board of Directors is composed. And then in terms of how the Board of Directors functions, we have all board members being non-executive members, and they are independent. And we have a board charter in terms of which we've crafted how we're going to conduct ourselves, all in terms of the King II report as well as on other corporate governance principles. The board has 4 board committees. One is the board executive committee, which I chair. That's a committee that looks at urgent business sometimes when the board can't meet. And then we've got the legal services committee, which is an important committee of the board that looks at the legal services delivery. That's the committee that is chaired by Mr. Mosamai Magume, who's with us here. And then we've got an audit committee that has ensured that we remain on track, and where we go off track, they point out where we've gone, and we take corrective action. That committee is headed by Dr. Len Connor. And then we have a remuneration committee that looks at the health of our employees in the organization. The board meets 4 to 5 times a year, and we do meet sometimes in terms of workshops and training workshops for board members. In terms of governance, specifically, we comply with good governance principles and guidelines as outlined in the King II report, as I've said, as well as in the government's governance framework. We have a toll-free ethics hotline. I think the CEO mentioned this. We have an internal audit department that reports to the audit committee. That's the unit in the organization that makes sure that all our processes and activities are in line and comply with legislation and other principles. In terms of challenges, Chair, under the finance and sustainability component, we have to mention that the National Treasury macro baseline macro increases are lower than CPI and wage settlements, and this leads to real-term decreases in the budget, our budget. As an example, the inflationary escalations experienced in our office leases, which is 9.5, and municipal costs, mainly by electricity, 31%, as well as vehicle fuel, 12%, are higher than how our budget is increased by National Treasury. And then I mentioned earlier that we've got unfunded mandates resulting from the introduction of new or amended legislation. Part of them is when costs are created and we are not consulted, and then there's an expectation for us to cover those costs. The global recession, that's a topic that doesn't need elaboration. And then we've got the recession impacting on donor funding and NGO work, resulting in a reduction in services offered by NGOs. By here, we just mean a number of NGOs shut down, I think, just after this country got democracy, because the view of donors was that when there's democracy, everything is in order, but that was a mistake. So those NGOs that were providing primary legal services shut down, and all those people then focused on the legal aid board to assist them. So that's by way of the challenges under that. And in terms of internal business processes and going forward, I'll request the CEO to take the baton once more, with your permission.
Okay, so we've reported on two components of our scorecard thus far. The first one was client and community. The second was the finance and sustainability. This is the third, internal business processes. And as I mentioned earlier, the delivery of legal aid is through three types of delivery systems: justice centers, judicare, and cooperation partners. And this next slide on slide 60 indicates that split in that pie chart. So you can see the bulk of it is provided through our own lawyers in our justice centers. In terms of the court coverage, we also, as I indicated, have coverage at all courts. We have also tried to interact with judicial officers at the local level to see if we could have dedicated legal aid courts, which would then allow us to use our resources in a more efficient way. We haven't been too successful, and this slide indicates that we haven't managed to persuade that. It's one of the things that also looked at in the criminal justice review. The practitioner per court ratios, the number of practitioners per courtroom in the district courts is almost 1:1. Now, that sounds like it's fine, but actually it's not, because the practitioners can't be in court all the time because they've got to prepare and consult and things. We have set up a system whereby they now spend 4 days in court and 1 day preparing and consulting, but we still need practitioners when some are on leave or off sick or away on training, etc. So that is where we have to look at it. In reception courts, which is the court where the first appearance is made, we have ensured that we have two practitioners per court, because that allows us to make sure that no one at that point goes unrepresented and that we link to the clients and then are able to link them to others. In our regional courts, our ratio is 1:1.8, and in our MTEF additional programs, we are requesting funding to increase that to 1.25. And especially with increased jurisdiction of regional courts, I think that that's also going to be important. In terms of the quality interventions that I mentioned earlier, these are the list of interventions that we make proactively to ensure that our lawyers provide quality services. And that includes that where we have CAs, we take them through a court readiness program and have an entire checklist which they must be able to be competent on in terms of what they've got to do for their clients before we actually allow them to appear in courts. And then in terms of other legal practitioners also, we have legal training support where we have linking to other external service providers or more senior lawyers within the organization, support in terms of specialist courts which includes, for example, the commercial crimes courts and the labor courts. And then we also have ensured that for each practitioner we have their own individual development plans, which ensures that they themselves look at how their experience levels and their skill level is increasing over the years. So those are the various things. And the last one includes that, as I said, dedicated day per week to consult. We also monitor their quality, and that happens by their supervisors at the Justice Center level and by the heads of the Justice Centers. But then we also cross-check that by our regional offices. So we don't just leave them to themselves, we also cross-check it. But importantly, in the past year, we've set up a legal quality assurance unit, which sits with our internal audit unit, which then allows an independent from the delivery section, an independent assessment of quality, so that we can then ensure that we are keeping up with the levels of quality and the quality targets that we've set for ourselves. Earlier we mentioned that there are a number of pieces of legislation which require us to provide legal assistance, including the Constitution. But other than the Constitution, you can see that there's provisions in each of those, and that slide 65 then lists those where we've got to provide assistance. Many of these link to civil legal assistance also, and that's where the challenge is, because then we don't have adequate capacity. And importantly then is this document, and the Legal Aid Act in sections 3A provides for the setting up of this guide, which this one here is the latest 2009 version, which was actually ratified by the National Assembly and the NCOP last year in October, November. And in that guide, we set out the policy and the procedures by which the legal aid scheme will be administered, so that it is a fair and transparent process. But importantly, it has to be approved by the executive authority and parliament. So in that case, it's something that is in line with what government wants to achieve. And then just a few slides on explaining the guide itself. As I indicated, that we have separated the policy and procedure sections of the guide so that it's easier to use. This version of the guide, we also made sure that it was written in plain English so that we cut out some of the legal jargon, and it's more, it can be used more readily by not only lawyers but also by non-lawyers, including NGOs and people outside of the legal aid system, in terms of looking at what's available, how they can access it, etc. The types of matters that we cover in criminal courts, in criminal matters rather, we are looking at in high courts and regional courts, we will assist in all matters in which the person qualifies for legal aid in terms of their means test, which means where they can't afford their own legal assistance. In the district courts, we don't assist in all matters. We do look at the means test, but once we have excluded certain matters, and those are listed in those paragraphs as indicated. But importantly, we don't assist in matters, for example, where the sentence is likely to be less than 3 months. Where there has been, where initially it was set up in that way, but we found that actually magistrates were giving sentences that were much higher, which then, contributed to those to unrepresented accused in those matters. We then made interventions and then amended those sections and brought them in also so that they didn't miss out on legal assistance. And then in criminal appeals also, we do assist wherever we've assisted clients, and if they need to lodge an appeal, we assist with those, and we have, however, limited it to one appeal, assistance in one appeal, which is because of the resources. Otherwise, we could actually go from one court to the next court and carry on going in terms of appeals, and that becomes at the expense of others. However, if there is a prospect for success in terms of going beyond one appeal, then we would assist those clients. The types of matters we do in terms of civil, as is indicated on that slide, what we include on the right-hand side, and that's slide 69, and what we exclude is listed on the left-hand side, and that indicates that we actually don't have the capacity to assist with everything, so we have to. But even those matters on the right-hand side, there are many instances in which we have to tell clients we're not able to assist them, or that we have to give them appointments which are a few months on so that they can come back for legal assistance if they still need it. In terms of who qualifies for legal aid, in terms of criminal legal aid, anybody who is physically resident in South Africa, whether they are a South African citizen or not, will qualify for legal aid if they meet the other criteria which was spelled out in the earlier slide, the means test as well as there being substantial injustice. Just to indicate that in the higher courts, there are also instances in which people may exceed the means test, when we come to the means test, you'll see the amounts, but they may not be able to afford the cost of the full duration of their trial. And in that case, if they weren't represented, there would be substantial injustice, so we have to assist them. In terms of civil legal aid, we also assist those who are resident, physically resident in South Africa, but they have to be citizens or permanent residents, which means we do not, in civil legal aid matters, assist those who are not not permanent residents or citizens. There is the means test, which is the basis on which we determine whether somebody can afford legal aid or not, and there we're looking at, on the right-hand side, the types of limits. In the case of single applicants, the net income, which is after-tax income, of 5,000 Rand per month. That was only increased now in the last legal aid approval, and households. And then in terms of assets, if there's no immovable property, the assets shouldn't be worth more than 75,000. And in the case of immovable property, 300,000. The reason we pitch that at that level, which may sound high to some, is because of the reality that in many of the poorer areas, houses, the values of houses did increase. And so what you would consider a basic house actually cost it. And that is why we made then the provision that, but they must be residents. So it's not additional houses, and definitely only one house. And then we also, beyond that, allow some discretion at our local justice center level to the heads of our offices if they exceeded by, let's say, more than not more than 1,000, then they could, because of the particular situation, provide legal assistance. So in which cases do we refuse legal aid? In criminal cases, we refuse legal aid if it's not listed for the district court and if they do not qualify in terms of the means test. And in civil cases, we must also, in addition to the means test, be satisfied that there is a merit in that case, which means we won't assist in civil matters if our lawyers have assessed the matter and have found that there's no merit there's no prospect of success. In that case, we would be wasting money. Tax basement, and so we felt that we need to limit it in that way. So that is those who don't. And then the one area that we also wanted to point to, which I alluded to earlier, it linked to the issue of where people exceed the means test but can't afford the cost of their own trial. However, there are many instances in which they do, and on paper it would seem, from everything that we have before us, that they don't have the means. But the lifestyles don't show that. And that's becoming a challenge for us, and that's what we've listed as legal challenges to the delivery of legal aid, where we have, in fact, argued this, and that's why we can mention this here. Otherwise, we wouldn't obviously be wanting to talk about our clients. But we have objected to and refused legal aid in these matters on the basis that even the courts have acknowledged certain lifestyles. Because they can't show any income, and people claim that they are living from trusts or actually not even from trusts, but from the benefit of their because of what they get from their children or anyone else, they don't have any money. And that's becoming a big challenge for us, because it's really, these are expensive cases, and in many of these poker matters, for example, that we have to assist in, very expensive. And then they also expect us to provide legal assistance at a level that we cannot afford, both in terms of the types of senior counsel, et cetera, that they want, but also the number of legal practitioners per accused that are required. And those also are becoming a challenge for us. Then there's also the issue of courts themselves ordering us. In those instances where we refuse, courts are required to, in terms of the Legal Aid Guide and the Legal Aid Act, to request a report from us officially. The court has to request a report from us indicating what we have considered, why we've refused, and whether that should be a basis for refusing legal aid. And then they themselves decide. They do have that right. The court has the right to decide. But in those instances, there have been many instances, rather, where they've ordered us. In fact, recently my execs were just telling me that there have been instances where they didn't ask us for reports and then they order us. And that's becoming the challenge for us, because what we are saying is that they are, they do have to ensure that people are represented in especially the more complex matters, and they have to make sure that their courts are run. But we also have to run a fair legal aid system, and we have to, you know, assist many people. So how do we find a balance between these things? So on that, what we are looking at, especially in the big cases, and this is on slide 74, that in the big matters, whether we should be looking at an expensive cases fund from the monies that are confiscated in terms of the poor car legislation, because that's what we need. Otherwise, just those, I mean, the millions of rand that go into that out of a budget that we're trying to reach 400,000 other people, it just eats into that budget. And so in that case, we should look at those types of things. And that whereas the judges, with due respect to judges, they obviously have the right to, and they should decide on what happens in their courts. The question is the applicability of that to other matters is best determined by us, because we have to administer the many other hundreds of thousands of matters that need legal aid. So that's an issue that we need to look at, and that's where the legal aid guide and the legal aid act become important in terms of how it establishes the boundaries within which legal aid has to be delivered. So those are some of the challenges. In terms of our internal business processes, some of the issues that we've listed on slide 75 are in rural areas where our reach itself in terms of our offices is limited. Even the ability to get duty care practitioners, private lawyers who could do the work for us, that does become a challenge in some instances. The high use of candidate attorneys. There was a stage where the entire system was based on a larger number of candidate attorneys. We've moved that now, and we have a larger number of PAs. Those are admitted attorneys. But we still have a fair number. 500 to 600 of our 1,500-plus lawyers are candidate attorneys. They are trained further by us before we use them in district courts. And for the simple matters, it is possible for them, with their level of training, to actually assist in those. But I think that what we are looking at is whether that's it's still a good ratio, whether we should reduce it more. So we still have candidate attorneys, but we should be using them with our PA. But that has cost implications. The supervisor to practitioner ratio is low at some of our justice centers. Insufficient and inadequate consultation facilities for our legal staff at courts and at prisons. And then the issue of interpretation, inadequate interpretation facilities. And then, as I mentioned in the earlier slides, the legal challenges to the delivery of legal aid. So moving on to the last section, Chairperson, of our presentation of our four components, it's looking at our own organizational and employee capacity to meet this challenge of delivering legal aid. The recruitment levels I mentioned earlier, 94, sitting at 94%, as you can see, vacancy rate 5.7, which means 94%, which we think is good, because it allows us to use our funds in a way which can mean that we can service our clients. Our average annual turnover rate in this past year decreased to 14.7%, which again is, if you look at it comparatively to others, is actually very good. And we also think that is good, because it means that our staff are now staying with us and we're building our experience levels and capacity. If we exclude CAs, and remember that CAs are on fixed-term contracts, it means that annual turnover drops to 7.2, which is even better. The people development programs, for us as the Legal Aid Board, as we said, we deliver legal services through our own lawyers. It means that we have to invest in our human capital. And these various people development programs ensure that we do invest in our people so that they can deliver the best quality service to our clients. And those include training, whether it's legal training or non-legal training. It includes ensuring that there's succession planning and career pathing so that people have a home in the organization, and many other such initiatives. The training stats on page 79 for non-legal and on page 80 for legal show that we are serious about training. We provide it, and we have training sections that provide it in a structured way, and that we are getting people to those training sessions, and that, in fact, in terms of the targets we ourselves set, we are exceeding those targets. We are also very pleased because of the fact that we have invested in our people, that we then looked at what are the requirements that we have to meet to accredit to be one of the best employees. And you would know that there is this whole system where private sector and public sector companies can apply, and they then have to meet all of these requirements which are listed on slide 81, and then they are given accreditation as a best employer. And we just now, in this past financial year, for the first time we were successful in that accreditation, and now it means that in our documentation we can also use that best employer logo, which indicates to people that this is a place that you would want to work at. So we think that that's also very important. To run a national network with offices across the country, other than trying to reach people in communities, for us itself, it can become a management challenge. And for that reason, technology has been amazing, and we use technology a lot in this period. And we have invested in that. That's one of the areas where we should be investing more. But we are linked in terms of all our offices, the email facilities, and we also have many applications by which we manage our organization, including a custom-made internal legal administration software. And what is important about this is this means that we generate all our data. The data that I shared with you earlier and the chairperson shared is generated through this process, whereby we input the data at one point when we provide legal aid. That data then becomes the same data that's used across. So we're not manually collecting data at different offices and trying to compile it and then check it and double check. This happens through the system, and that is quite important. It's also geared to indicate which are the whether you can or can't provide legal aid in certain matters, this administration system. So it means that the system itself checks those things also. And then finally, I think that we also use HR and finance packages which assist us. So in terms of this component of our scorecard, what would be our challenges? It would be the adequate legal staffing and unequal allocation of resources within the justice cluster, the sharing of resources across justice, whether it's to us, to the prosecution, and to others, the development of specialist skills. As the chairperson indicated in his first section, we had to get to this path of high performance over this past decade by building our organization bit by bit, and we have done it. And as we have consolidated this, we now have to pay attention to these more complex matters which require specialist skills, which we might have outsourced in the past, but which we now do ourselves also, and there to build that specialist skills to do that. Also, adequate resources for training of staff, and then OSD Phase 2. OSD was... The phase one was, it has been implemented for legal professionals within the justice cluster and generally across government. And phase two is just an outstanding part which needs to be wrapped up, and linked to that, a fair performance management system. One of the reasons we believe that we have managed to get to where we are is a very strong performance management system, where every person in our organization has a contract, performance contract, against which they are individually managed to deliver, which then allows us to deliver on our entire business plan. So that is why we think that that's important to conclude. And then the last one is that investment in the IT infrastructure. So in summary, what are some of the challenges that we have as an organization? We have mentioned this through this, but just to wrap up, these are some of the challenges on slide 86, the inadequate practitioner for court, the unequal resourcing across the justice cluster, the limited capacity to do civil legal aid, the access to Legal Aid South Africa services by clients in rural areas, quality of legal services, sustainability problems in the paralegal sector, the high number of candidate attorneys in our district courts, the consultation facilities, and the legal challenges. What are the challenges in our non-legal part of our organization? As we indicated, the issue of macro increases, which are lower than the CPI in terms, and also the contractual obligations, the wage settlements, it means in real terms we have decreases. Because we deliver the services ourselves, our salaries budget is high because the main thing we do is deliver services, and therefore we've got to have lawyers. So our salaries budget takes up 2/3 of our budget, and therefore if the wage settlement is higher than what is allowed, it means in real terms we are going to struggle. OSD, unfunded mandates, which is introducing new legislation with very good intentions but not having the funds to provide for it, skilled personnel, and then IT infrastructure. Again, in terms of a summary, as a summary on page 89, where are we at in 2009 in terms of infrastructure, staffing, finances? We've been through all of these. In terms of legal services delivery, the number of matters, the number of finalized matters, the split in delivery systems. So that then is a good wrap-up in terms of where we are at. And on performance, that we reach all the criminal courts. Our national footprint expansion is expanded to the extent we can. In the last year, we opened 3 justice centers in Botshabelo, Bellevue, and Soshanguve, and in many more rural areas. We are trying to set up the satellite offices. The number of matters we've done, civil matters and criminal, and then also the dedicated program which is focused on children awaiting trial, and as generally ensuring that the awaiting trial prisoners, that those numbers are tracked and to make sure that they are represented. And then in terms of our non-legal parts, that our governance structures and are strong, and that we ensure that we operate our organization in terms of that, that our staff recruitment level is at a high of 94%. We have successfully implemented OSD Phase 1. We have successfully accredited as I said, as a best employer. We have a record of unqualified audits, this being the 8th one. The rebranding of Legal Aid Board as Legal Aid South Africa is in keeping with this, and that our IT network platform, the extent to which we have it, is strong. And to just then indicate what the way forward is, I'll hand over to the chairperson again. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just in closing, just as to what, in our view, would be the way forward, we've identified that an expansion of our national footprint is a good way to go to increase access, increase Legal Aid South Africa's capacity to render civil legal aid services. We've mentioned that we are limited in that regard. We also have identified that we need to improve linkage with community structures and organizations. We need to enhance Legal Aid South Africa's legal advice service and online services, as well as improve our practitioner-to-court ratio to improve coverage of courts and to improve our quality. In terms of building the organizational capacity, we think we need to continue to build a strong organizational culture to develop and competencies of our staff to deliver on our mandate. We need to continue our high level of accountability and efficiency, and we need to continue to develop best practices in our operations. And we need to continue communication with the clients and community to increase awareness of legal aid services as well as of the rights and signs in our constitution. Chair, that's our presentation. Most of the details are in the document, and we are here to deal with questions and issues that may be raised by members of the committee. Once more, thank you very much for giving us this opportunity. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, members.
Thanks. I mean, I think just to say that I think the presentation has been very impressive, and I think the turnaround, from what the Legal Aid Board was and the services it provided to what it is now is very impressive and quite dramatic even. So I think really to congratulate the members of the board, the CEO and the staff for the work that they are doing. Just then maybe some comments and a few questions. Having said that, it's very difficult to assess what's really happening, and this is not so much to the board, but to the chairperson and the other members of the committee. I do think we've got to look at, which we've never done before, at oversight, and actually visiting. You will pick up. I think the chairperson of the board had mentioned, right at the beginning, the perceptions. And you would pick up those perceptions that cases take a long time to be finalized because the legal aid board attorney doesn't pitch. But those are all sort of anecdotal. What we really need to do is to visit some courts, hear from the magistrates, the prosecutors, the role players, how is the legal aid board system functioning. And I think only in that way can we really assess. Otherwise, it's sort of very much anecdotal. Maybe on a constituency level, sort of unannounced visits to get a sort of real picture, and then as the portfolio committee, meetings scheduled with different role players in different courts. I mean, we can even start in the Western Cape just to get a sense right here. So that's just a general comment, but I think we need to do oversight. Then just really as far as questions, the one would be the difference between a justice center and a satellite office. And I'm particularly interested in the satellite office. Is it a full-time office? If so, what about maybe visiting areas like once or twice a week or fortnight? Because if you look at the problem is you're representing poorer people, and if you look at that slide with the map, there are big differences. I see you're planning to open an office in Calvinia. One of the things that struck me was the Northern Cape. I mean, how vast that is. I don't know if at the moment Calvinia people have to go to other places in the Northern Cape or whether they can go to closer places in the Western Cape. Because also, I think, got the roads problem. I don't think there's a tar road from Calvinia to a close tar road from Calvinia to the Northern Cape centres, whereas the tar roads come from Cape Town. So really just that. One other question would be, is there any, just on the training aspect, is there any relationship between justice centres, legal aid board staff and community development workers? Because they are playing an increasingly important role at a local government level in terms of advice and things like that. I don't know if you've looked at that aspect. And then CEO, I'm sure you knew this one was going to come from me, the issue of the farm dwellers. Where are we with that? And Chairperson and the other members of the committee who weren't here before. Basically, as I think was raised in the inputs, there's a statutory requirement for legal aid for certain types of land cases, evictions and so on. And that has been upheld by the courts. There's a legal obligation on the Minister of then Minister of Land and Agriculture and Minister of Justice to provide that. We took this up as the previous Legal Aid Board, I think, is more than happy to do that. The Legal Aid Board is more than happy to do that. The problem is a question of funding and a different approach from different role players. The DG Justice having a particular view, the DG then of Land Affairs having a different view. Land Affairs wanted to then set up really what was effectively a duty care system with as far as farm dwellers. And there were questions raised about the accessibility of that. You know, a panel of lawyers, but those lawyers end up being in the bigger centres, whereas with the legal aid network, you've got duty care centres and satellite offices justice centres, rather, and satellite offices over a wide range of the country. But where are we with that? We basically did get political agreement that the Legal Aid Board should provide the service, but the sense one got was that there wasn't great happiness from officials from different sectors. And I want to then ask the board what's the update, but Chair, that's also, I think, an issue we need to focus on with the, what is it now, Rural Development Portfolio Committee. So, yeah, I think those were really just the questions and comments.
Thank you, Chairperson. Start by saying we were supposed to attend an ad hoc committee. That's why we arrived a little bit late with the Honorable Smart. Yes. And good day, Judge. I want to align myself with the Honorable JJ. Judge, when you say in the past, the system nearly brought the Legal Aid Board down. I just want to add to say, not only the Legal Aid Board, but also practitioners, sole practitioners who were waiting endlessly for their fees to be paid. Some of them
I will say, collapsed along the way. But we are saying we are now happy to see the turnaround. And further than that, maybe I should preface my comment with something, because if I just comment, it may sound as if I'm opposed or negative against the legal effort or legal aid as a system. I support legal aid quite a lot. I started in the days of Professor Margaret Mason at universities, and like I was a convener at Zululand University, and I've also established a legal aid structure at Vista University in Mamelodi campus, as well as at NEPILA, applied for accreditation with the Law Society. I'm saying this, Judge, because when you look at your successes, they appear to be a threat to the legal practitioners. And more so, if you look at the guide, you are providing legal aid for the means test is about 5,000 rand per month. It covers a large number of people who are earning less than that. For example, we heard from Samuel Strike that they are earning much less than 5,000 rand per month. So which means the legal aid board will provide, for example, legal aid to any employee of the local of the municipality. And I don't know what are you paying for Judicare, because if one would like to compare to say you are providing legal aid through the justice centers with your attorneys there, but how does it compare to a legal practitioner taking a matter on legal aid basis? Can one not say the fee for the Judicare is so little that a practitioner will be discouraged from doing a legal aid matter or a matter on a legal aid basis? Therefore, at the end of the day, most of the matters will be handled by the legal aid, by the legal aid board. And also, what is impressing, I've been listening in the past, you know, they used to say, more especially the interpreters, when a person has got to choose whether he will prefer represented by the legal aid or his own lawyer, they will say, do you want a state attorney? And most of the people say, no, I can't be represented by the state attorney when I'm fighting with the state. Others used to say, do you want a Mahala lawyer? And then the person will say, oh, will the Mahala lawyer really represent me properly? But now of late, really, I don't know whether it's due to the education we are doing through the radios and the like. At least they say, do you want a lawyer who is paid by the legal aid board? And then person will then ask what type of that lawyer, and they realize that it's like any other lawyer, et cetera, et cetera. And then maybe in conclusion, I would like to say, we visited Portsmouth Prison. You mentioned that in your briefing to say the challenges in consulting with clients and the like. But in Portsmouth Prison, it came out very strongly to say a legal aid board attorneys don't visit clients in prison. They meet them first time in court. I want to find out how has that been now addressed. Is it still a huge challenge, more especially those at correctional services? And also maybe if you can say, insofar as restitution of land rights, what is envisaged? Will the legal aid board deal with each and every person who has submitted a claim, or is it going to be maybe in terms of the whole people who were either evicted in the past? Are you going to be doing a case by case, individual by individual, etc.? Also, maybe an update on the Buremach tribe. How far is it? Is it nearing its closure? How much has the legal aid was spent up to so far? Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I'm also happy to Yeah, that's the problem of non-payment of lawyers who give services on the basis of the services of the legal aid board now has been resolved. I would have been happier if it was possible to maybe get a comment, even if in the report by the legal aid board itself, as to the corroboration of that position by lawyers' organizations, because I used to hear a lot of them complaining about this. But as I say, I appreciate that now that problem has been resolved. On this question of unfunded mandates, where there are laws that are made by Parliament that will require the involvement of the legal aid board, only to find that the relevant department hasn't made mine available, what interventions does the legal aid board make? Do you monitor, for instance, the question of the making of such laws so that at an appropriate stage you are in a position to call on the relevant department to make the funds available? Because you would find that in the draft legislation that comes before Parliament, at the back of the document there will be a question as to what are the financial implications. A number of times we find that the statement is to the effect that there are no legal, there are no financial implications. So I wonder then if you have a way of monitoring the making of legislation to ensure that you don't find yourself settled with such unfunded mandates. On the question of access to legal aid services by clients in rural areas, well, I always have difficulties with government bodies informing us that they have problems with getting access to rural areas. And yet the people who need the services of the state the most are those who live in those areas. Well, what measures are you putting in place to ensure that this difficulty in accessing of legal aid services by rural citizens is addressed? For instance, I know that we have traditional authority offices. Do you have you considered making use of them to ensure that at least you are able to make yourselves available to your possible clients? I know that you lawyers have no place in those courts, in those offices, in terms of the trial of cases, be they criminal or civil, because there's no need for lawyers there. But the structures are there for the legal aid board to inform the people and maybe consult with them as well. Now, on this matter that has been raised quite sharply by both speakers before me, land restitution and the Labor Tenants Act, ESTA and PIE, I see that on page 69 you say funds must still be made available. Is it because of what they said here earlier that the Department of Land Affairs, TARAF at the time called, is reluctant to hand over those funds to the legal aid board in because they want to set up their own set of lawyers? What exactly is it that lead you to say the funds still need to be made available when money is there for such cases to be dealt with? On page 59, Chair, there's reference to under-delivery systems, cooperation partners. Who are these? What are cooperation partners? And somewhere, I don't remember the page, but it's about the use of funds, where you talk about, it's on page 50, and financial performance description, salaries and related costs. Below that, there's direct expenditure. What is direct expenditure as compared to other expenditures, like operating expenditure and so on? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, let me start by saying that I think the Legal Aid Board, especially under the pressures which are they work under do an exceptionally good job. But there are a couple of suggestions, and maybe there's answers to these suggestions that one could make in a very practical sense. For example, as someone that studied law and then went and did my articles, I can tell you that at no stage was it ever suggested to me as a law student that I could go to the legal aid board and do my articles there. And in actual fact, and I mean absolutely no disrespect whatsoever, but it was considered a pretty unsexy, sort of cool thing that you would go and do, was to go and work for the state, because everyone had this idea when you left university that you were going to walk around in a fancy suit with a briefcase and act like Ally McBeal. And, you know, things were going to be very, very glamorous. And the legal aid board just, I mean, it was probably the most unglamorous thing anyone could think of doing when leaving university. Then another thing, you know, when you study, especially, well, now it's only an LLB, but, you know, there are a couple of subjects that you do that are completely, they're useless, they're a waste of time. And, you know, I, as someone that studied the law up until pretty recently, knew very little about the legal aid board. Now, it would be very helpful and very useful if somewhere in one of the subjects, a module about what the legal aid board is, why it's established and what it does, is built into the education of future lawyers, so that future lawyers know exactly what this board is and, more importantly, why this board exists and the background, the history to the legal aid board. Chair, and then just one thing that worries me slightly. As parliamentarians, you know, we get the general public sending us comments and questions and asking for help. And we had a very interesting one recently where a young lady who's a teacher got hold of us to say that she's in the process of going through a divorce. And it was a pretty nasty divorce, to put it mildly. And she approached the legal aid board for assistance. And they said to her that she didn't meet the criteria. Now, when she sent through her information, in fact, it was true. She didn't meet the criteria. She earned more than 5,000 rand a month after tax had been deducted, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But what hadn't been taken into account was that she was a single mother of four children and could not spare a single cent of that money, regardless that it was over the amount, because she was paying to feed four children and to clothe, et cetera. Now, is there some way that in a case like this, a case can go on review? That there's a committee that sits and looks at individual cases and says, well, look, you know, you don't meet the criteria, but because of these extenuating circumstances, we are willing to help you in this matter. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think one would want to echo the positive comments made by the committee with regard to apparently hard work that is being done. A lot of things are done, you can see. Again, I'm crying to a person from the wilderness in the desert. maybe these are conceptual issues that even the committee needs to engage on. Probably even before going there, when the chief spoke passionately about access to rural areas and so on, I looked at Vulindoba. I think when you say Vulindoba, it's a grass of some kind, Emakhaya. If you really are good, you open it so that things can be revealed. So what will it do? It applies more in the rural community. And I said maybe Vulindoba will respond to him. you look at this document and its structure. It articulates the mandate of the board. It articulates the act that governs the operation of the board. It explains the pre-2000. If you look at the 2000 explanation, it speaks about the nature of the board. And then it speaks about the post-2000, it speaks about the board. And then as it moves on, it speaks about what you call strategy priority. You call it strategy priority 6. I don't know whether it's 6 strategic priorities or it's strategic priority 6. And I don't know where is strategy priority 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And it articulates what it calls the 1-1, 1-2, and so on. And then it goes and articulates a vision and a mission. I call these abstract issues, yet they are very, very critical for effective communication. Because if you, I want to insist a person about maybe having time to discuss this issue for a common framework in interacting with one another. That having read this plan, I'm going to come and be very, very cynical. I don't know what the board is responding to. What I know is the reason why the board is responding. It sounds very stupid if I put it that way. Because if you say, for instance, proportion of prosecutors to that, so shortage of lawyers to that, conditions of the court and so on, the lack of this type of training and whatever, quality intervention, quality assurance, and all those kind of things. It appears those are the things that you want to improve. But why do you want to improve those things? To me, it's what is missing in the what to call, in the document. Because I guess you don't want to improve finances or the efficiency of the operation of the port for the sake of the efficiency. You don't want to improve the number of quality lawyers or types of trained lawyers for the sake of that. There is that issue that we're supposed to be responding to. I'm saying a problem nature to me would have been in two contexts. One is the one you have articulated in the document, that what was the state of the organization and whatever, and how are you responding to that? But what is it? Why do we have a legal aid board? Do we have it because of the shortage of lawyers? Do we have it because... I can list all these issues that are written here. Let me just go to slide number... Slide number... Sorry, Chaperson. For instance, if you go to just one example, slide number 38. Slide number 38, your first bullet point there says, I'm trying to fish for the reasons why we have legal aid board. I'm fishing for it. It says, low practitioner per court ratio, insufficient to meet demand at the court. All those issues are things that we are trying to correct. But are they the primary reason that we are doing this? Low practitioner per court resulting in high case loads for practitioners. What is the ill in society that actually can manifest in the ordinary man's eyes, which actually make us respond to this sort of call? What I'm trying to say is that when we articulate the problem statement, there's core area and institutional area. And I think in the institutional area, the response is very clear. So there's a lot of things that are being done. There's a lot of things that are to do and to be done. That things that you say you are going to do, things that you have done. And you say outcomes, you list outcomes. When you list outcomes, it's because you are responding to something. Issues like how many lawyers you employ, how many cases you respond to, and how many lender you do. You either deal with output or interventions there. But outcome must be something more tangible outside that, whether it's in society, in the state of society, and so on. What is this problem that we're responding to? Right. I'm trying to. Yeah, you say, for instance, when you say, for instance, yes, I'm happy for that. You say outcome one, an effective and efficient justice factor is realizable within our mandate. Why do we think it's not effective now? You say justice for all focusing on the poor and vulnerable, that's an outcome. For all focusing on the poor and vulnerable and ensuring that the constitution is living, document. What is the situation now? A sustainable, efficient, and independent organization fulfilling its mandate. And the question is, what is the situation now? When we meet you after 5 years, why shall we say you've made a difference in that? And where do we base that? And because of the number of lawyers, whatever, you get what I'm trying to say? Where is the definition of that problem? Well, if you're working on behalf of the legal aid point, you can assist me. But of course, if you can, you don't have to be in the legal aid point. I accept members must. Maybe you can help me. But what is the definition of that problem? Because I guess there must be a reason why you have a special institution like this, because that institution demonstrates its skills to define the nature of the problem that it's dealing with. So that as you intervene, we must be able to say it's only you who can deal with that matter, not anybody else. So I'm saying there's a lot of good work that has been done all over, but I'm not comfortable to say in a very structured way what is this animal that we're dealing with. Sounds like a very cynical question, but an abstract word. I repeat everything. I'm in the desert. I'm crying.
I'm very much sure of the question. Reflecting the position in the desert. Not very sure what the real question is. but I'm sure we can debate that later.
Thank you. I forgot one aspect in my...
Oh, they're trying to answer. Honorable. You forgot.
I forgot. Okay. Judge. The Constitution emphasizes or bases the right to legal aid on if substantial injustice would otherwise happen or arise, yes. But if I look at the legal aid guide, it seems it doesn't look on that, because it seems to be putting forward the ability to afford a cost for his own or her own legal representation. Am I interpreting the guide correct? Is the requirement still that it should be if substantial injustice would otherwise result? But if you look at the district court, it would appear that the legal aid will be provided without inquiring whether. No, on the High Court, the legal aid on High Court, without further inquiry into the nature and seriousness of the judge. That's what I want the judge to clarify on.
I'd like to invite the board to give us some responses, engage the committee on the questions that have been thank you, Chair. I think we will share the responses. I've got my executives here who are direct in charge of some of the issues. But I think an issue that's capable of being resolved very early is the question raised by His Honourable Sengungubele. What he's talking about is what is the context within which we crafted our strategic plan. We've dealt with that comprehensively in our strategic plan document itself. It is available, it is there. Now, it's a document that we submitted in terms of our regulatory framework to the minister last year. So what we've got in our presentation is an extract from our strategic plan. But all the issues that you mentioned as to why we want to do the following things are set out there. There's the overcrowding in prisons, how many people serving life sentences, the population demographics of South Africa, the number of lawyers in the country, all those are in this document, Chair. We've done that. Yeah.
going to be in the document packs that we are going to give you. And, Chair, I would be happy if the committee feels that we need to come back to talk about the strategy plan itself. We are always prepared to come and talk about it. But I'm happy that the Honorable Ngubele raised the issue. It is here. We didn't deal with it here because we didn't want to give a very long presentation, but it's there. That's an issue. I think in terms of the perception and the oversight visits, I would welcome that. I'm sorry, but I'm going to make this example. Inkosi Holomisa attended the launch of our Mthatha Justice Center many years ago. I don't know if you remember.
I do.
And on that podium, he thanked us for opening an office there because it was looked at as a rural area. But he was also critical of our reach in rural areas, and he hasn't changed his stance. I think we will give you more information, Your Honor, about what our efforts are. It's not a question of us not reaching rural areas. It's a question of people in those areas reaching us. It's a question of location of our resources. But we will deal with it. So I'm just mentioning his attendance of our Mthatha Justice Center launch to say I would be happy if more members would do that. Just come to a Justice Center unannounced. See how you are received. I've had occasion as chair of the board where receptionists told me to get lost because they didn't know me. But that's part of how an organization grows. You just go unannounced to see how things happen and you engage people. And it would be happy because I think the issues of the perception and all those other issues will come more to the fore to yourselves. I think in terms of the land matters, I know we say in our slide that money is still to be made available. But the fact of the matter is that work is not done by us. It was outsourced by Land Affairs to Chidwell Thompson and Hazel, a private law attorney. It's on a duty care basis. We have our views about the sustainability of that system. But whatever matters come to us on those matters, we refer them in terms of that because we don't have the money to respond to that need. I think that should answer all those questions about the land-related matters. We had tried to explore a cooperation agreement with the Department of Land Affairs, but at some stage they decided to go the judicare model and outsource the work to a private firm of attorneys. But we believe we have the resources nationally, even in rural areas, that can do the work. But it's up to the department concerned to decide. And we believe that our use of in-house lawyers has proven itself to be a lot more cost-effective than the judicare model itself. It's a lot more cost-effective, yes. The 39,000 or 38, I don't know how many matters that judicare did, cost us just under 100 million. I'm just giving an example. Those matters that we farmed out to judicare cost us just, I think, about 89 million. If I'm not mistaken, about 89 million, less than 50,000 matters. But totally we've done over 434. In fact, we did 395 as justice centers. That should tell you that the justice center model, in our view, is a lot more cost-effective. That's why we went there. I'm going to ask, Brian, do you think you can deal with the justice center satellite office difference and what is a satellite office, please?
Thanks, Judge. Good day, members of Parliament and Chairperson. Just to elaborate on the issue of justice centers and satellite offices, our primary delivery vehicle in terms of our in-house model is the justice center, which is where we have an office composed of lawyers and support staff headed by a justice center executive. The justice centers are structured to cover a coverage area of plus minus 100, 200, 300 kilometers square. Okay, so we can only have so many justice centers in terms of our footprints within each province or region. Now, sometimes the coverage is too large. For instance, in some provinces, you may find a justice center covers a square radius of over 100, 200 kilometers. So when we have to cover courts, that are over 100 kilometers, our lawyers spend a long time driving to these courts, and it wastes a lot of time. It's inefficient. So what we have done is we have developed branch offices. We call them satellite offices, which are staffed by lawyers, and they are able to access the courts quite close to where the office is located. What we also do is ensure that we have a paralegal full-time at these satellite offices to ensure access to the communities in which these offices are served so that we can actually reach clients in civil matters. So paralegals will provide advice as well as accept instructions from clients if they can, if it's a civil matter, and then we'll get our civil attorneys at the Justice Centers to do. So a satellite office is actually a branch office of a Justice Center to ensure that we cover the area that the Justice Center is able to cover more efficiently and effectively.
Thank you, Chair. Could I just invite my executives to deal with those questions? Like Patrick, there's a question on training. Could you deal with that? Cordelia, there's a question on Portsmouth Prison. Could we just deal with those? I'll look at those that remain, then we'll deal with them. With your permission, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge. Chair and members of Portfolio Committee, thank you. I think I'll deal with a couple of areas, specifically visiting areas in terms of that, and that's one of the pilot projects that we're looking at in terms of testing our practitioners going to, in, say, magistrates' courts where some magistrates are prepared to make an office available for us for a paralegal and our civil PAs to go and visit. But obviously it links to a capacity issue in terms of you can only spread the number of matters you have with the number of practitioners, so what you really would be doing is spreading it. But to then go and visit those areas all link into pension pay points, and that's a pilot project we're trying to look to see how effectively we can implement something to then go to areas to link to people. So all in terms of GCIS's initiative in terms of having one-stop government services that we link into those. So we're looking at how we can link in and to take and visit areas. And on a similar basis to what we visit advice offices, we already have a visitation program in terms of what our CEO mentioned, to link to advice offices to where they're not able to do the legal services, that we can do the backup legal services. So we do also link into communities at the advice offices, but the challenges are there, a lot of them are closing. But so we are looking at that specifically. In regard to the training, we have a broad spectrum of training, and obviously some of the issues link to client sensitivity issues. But we're also looking at our paralegals and training in regard to our paralegals in terms of a broad spectrum of issues. So we've got specific training programs, an introductory training program, an advanced one we're having now where we're looking at certain service providers, Black Sash, looking at some of the issues that communities may face. So to deal with them on that basis so that they can understand in terms of what the issues in communities that they're able to assist and give advice and give the first level advice and assist. But if they're not able to do it and it's a matter that requires litigation, then moves on to our civil practitioners. But in terms of training, obviously, we look at the broad spectrum in terms of the needs of our practitioners. We do it in terms of looking at what are the skills required for a specific position, what skills the practitioner has, and look at the gaps and then decide what we need to do in terms of our training curriculum to address those gaps. And so we're building on that on an ongoing basis, I think, from a training perspective. In terms of, I think in terms of the farm dwellers issue, I just need to clarify that there are two programs in terms of that's running. The land restitution is done by the Commission on Land Restitution. They have the obligation in terms of the Act. They also, we try to enter negotiations with them in terms of a cooperation agreement from a funding perspective. That ultimately we didn't continue, and they decided themselves to then set up their own scheme to run that. In terms of the issue from Land Affairs perspective in terms of evictions in terms of ESTA and also Labour tenants, they went out to tender, and those, of course, are then awarded to Cheadle Thompson in terms of the tender. There we've also engaged with them because the issue is a sustainability. Because we have a number of matters that we've taken on that we want them to take over, but they don't have the ability to take them over because of the numbers. So that links to our concern as to the sustainability of that. Then in terms of the means test, in terms of 5,000 Rand per month, I think in terms of that there is a discretion, but then going further in terms of the example of the teacher, there is a discretion built into the legal aid guide. Now, you'll find in civil matters, there isn't a discretion for the Justice Centre executives or regional executives to go beyond the means test. But in terms of paragraph, I think that's, I'll give you the exact paragraph, 10.2.2 paragraph A, the NOE, the National Operations Executive, has a discretion, and he may consider the application any person who does not qualify under the means test but who subjectively judged is indigent and deserves sympathetic consideration on the grounds of exceptional other circumstances. So he may consider it, so it doesn't necessarily stop with the means test. There is a discretion built in. And we have a standard form that advises someone of their rights to appeal against the refusal of legal aid, which they are required to be given when legal aid is refused. So they know what process to follow, and there is the appeal procedure that is built in terms of the legal aid guide, and there's a standard form advising them of that. Obviously, in terms of, I think we must also just clarify, the means test is not the be-all and the end-all for us at the end of the day. The means test determines whether someone is indigent or not. It doesn't determine whether someone is able to afford the cost of their legal representation as required in terms of the Constitution. It's only the starting point. Because the means test may say you're indigent, but the fact that you have a trial or that you exceed our means test doesn't mean you can afford a trial that's going to run for 4 years in terms of your means. If you can afford a trial for 1 week, yes, but not necessarily for 4 years, and that's the problem, and that's the situation. Those are the factors we have to take into account to determine whether you should get legal aid and whether you're able to afford the cost of your legal representation as required by the Constitution, rather than the question whether you are indigent or not. And so that's the difficulty you face. But the means test can deal with 99.5% of our clients, that they fall within those means tests, and it's a very simple administrative way how we can deal with it. It's the other 5% that we then have to look at further, and there's a special committee specifically set up to look at those issues in terms of the guide. The interpretation issues, I can maybe come in there. We've engaged specifically with Justice College, who train the interpreters, but I think what we've got to understand is interpreters really interpret what judicial officers should be informing the accused in terms of their rights, in terms of the Constitution. So we've also linked to Justice College at this stage in terms of magistrates as to how they should be informing accused of their rights to legal representation. In fact, we've started a program now where there's training of interpreters, that we have one of our regional representatives, our regional legal managers, going there when they're specifically dealing with the issue of interpretation of your rights to legal representation. Specifically, so we move away from this interpretation in terms of it's a Mahala lawyer, 112 lawyer. But of course, the interpreter status, we really interpret what the magistrates tell us to interpret. And we're saying, well, obviously, if they tell you, just most magistrates will say, advise the accused of their rights. We want you to explain it in this way, and so that we interact with them. And so that's how we're trying to then interact. But we've also got to educate some of the judicial officers as to the critical role they play in explaining the rights to accused. And I think we've also now asked Justice College, and obviously we will then judge can link to the new training institute for judicial officers in terms of that they sensitize judicial officers on the important role they play in informing accused of their rights. Unfunded mandates in terms of what we do. Yes, we do monitor legislation in terms of new legislation coming through in terms of how it will impact, one, on the legal aid board, and two, on our potential, on our clients or potential clients. And obviously one of the issues we do look at is the costing of the implementation of the legislation. And we have made presentations when specifically this committee has previously considered various pieces of legislation, the cost implications for us. But obviously it's very much bound in terms of statistics, so the availability of statistics sometimes becomes very difficult to estimate what the impact's going to be, sometimes due to the lack of statistics in terms of the Mental Health Care Act, just as an example. So you get statistics which you can feel are not 100% that you can rely on them, but that's the best you have, and you've got to then base your costings on those. So we do it, but for me, I think the problem is the breakdown between that and how money gets allocated and how it gets divided, and I think that's an issue that we've got to look at as to how that process happens. Are we done? I'm just trying to think. There was one more issue. I think that's it done from my side. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Ma'am?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Honourable members, I will deal with the issue of We have special consultation days, our attorneys.
Can you switch off that mic? Yes, sir. Yeah, thank you. And I'll turn it towards yourself. So
thank you, Mr. Chair. Our attorneys have special consultation days where they arrange with the wardens and people at Paulsville Prison to go and consult with their clients on particular days during the week. We have been experiencing some very special challenges with Paulsville Prison where we are not allowed in to go and see our clients. Where we, our clients are called, arrangements have been made, our clients are called, they cannot be found. We've also been there recently as 2 weeks ago where our clients, arrangements were made, our clients were called, they couldn't be found. We sat there for 2 to 3 hours waiting to see our clients and eventually we could not see them. Paulsville also does not allow us to come in after certain hours, 1400 hours every day, so we try and go through as early as possible in the morning because of that. To deal with some of these challenges, what we have done, we've called a meeting with the area commissioners, Mr. Lafranchi and Mr. Mafenkwe, to deal with some of these challenges, and they are slowly but surely being dealt with. But those are some of our challenges. But we are consulting as far as possible with our clients who are being kept in Paulsville. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you want to come in? Yes, I think somebody else. Oh.
Yeah. Thank you, Chairperson. But maybe to deal with the principle of consultation with clients and the fact that there's quite a lot of times when our lawyers are accused of only consulting with clients at the time of trial. And I think in terms of our operations, we're quite clear in terms of what we require from practitioners, that they are to ensure consultations take place long before the matter goes on trial. And I'd like to report that to a large extent that objective is achieved. It is the exception where you'd find that a lawyer would not meet with the client and maybe only consult with him on the actual day. And it's that exception, unfortunately, that becomes known more often. And there's many reasons why that takes place. On a few occasions, it could be that practitioners, as Cordelia has mentioned, in terms of Paulsville, we may set up a consultation with the accused in prison, but when we go there, we are not able to actually interact with the client. And hence, when the matter comes to court, we have no option but to actually request permission from the court to consult. Quite often you find that when accused are on bail and consultations are made for them to visit our offices so that they can meet with the lawyers, those interviews don't take place. It could be that the client cannot afford the cost of coming to the office or the client forgot, etc. And then when we go to court, we find ourselves in the embarrassing position that we have not consulted. And again, we have to. What we have done is in order to ensure that from ourselves, when we monitor this case, we want to do it, we are requiring our lawyers to ensure that they write it in their notes. The reason why they consult on the day of the trial. So we are quite observant of it. We want to actually reduce it to nil if possible. It's an objective that we don't think we'd be able to realize fully, but we want to actually manage quite closely. So I just thought I should just give a little bit more. If I may judge, there's a few other issues that I think I can actually pick on, and that is the interaction with our staff, with community organizations. And I think the first speaker actually raised this issue, and we have got an objective to actually try to increase access as much as possible. So at every one of our justice centers, we have outreach programs, and it's covered slightly in the presentation, where there's an obligation on our heads of offices to network with all NGOs, community-based organizations, faith-based organizations, etc., to ensure that they are aware of the services we provide and they're able to actually refer clients. We're going even further right now, and we're saying that in the satellite offices, where the walk-in client to our office is not as high as we expect, that we actually request our paralegals to go and actually work for a certain number of days in community facilities, such as constituency office or municipal offices, on a regular scheduled basis, so the community is aware that on certain days in the month, a legal aid board practitioner or paralegal will be able to consult with the communities, so that we can actually give some advice. In terms of who our core partners are, we enter into agreements with partners who are maybe non-government organizations or university law clinics to render legal aid services on our behalf where we don't have particular skills in a particular area, or our coverage in terms of our national footprint may not actually reach to certain areas. And then you find that, for instance, in Mpumalanga, we have got a cooperation agreement with the Mpumalanga Land Legal Cluster. It's because we don't have the coverage to offer that service to that community. There's a particular gap, and this NGO has the ability and the skills to provide a better service. So we will fund them to represent clients on a legal aid basis. So we have got a few partners that are there. With regard to the Burumak matter, we're expecting this matter to be finalized within the next year. The state has closed that case. The defense is now in process, and more than 50% of that case is over. In terms of money, we have already paid in excess of 20 million rands on this case. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I think one of the questions asked by Honourable Member Mr. Ngubela was on page 38 or slide 38, wants to know what is the reason to meet the demands at court. Now, the reason is very simple. I think it has been alluded to by previous speakers. The demands at court for our practitioners is such that, and then it answers to the question of preparedness. We would like to have more practitioners per court, because if the one is running a trial, the other one should be at the prison to consult. And that is the reason why we would like to meet the demand for that. The other, and there are many more the reasons why, the caseload for, to reduce the caseload for practitioners is because we want to increase the service level. We want want our practitioners to perform well. And when we reduce the caseload per practitioner, we want the practitioner to be able to spend time on a matter in such a manner that he or she is able to be competitive. And he or she, because you must understand that the perceptions of the past still live with us, so we need to make sure that we get it. So we want our practitioners to be specialists and to be able to perform well for clients. It's not that we should be the Mahala attorney or Section 112 attorneys. And I think the other question that was asked by JJ on the issue of judicare vis-a-vis in-house attorneys. Now, you have been told about 20 million that has been spent already on Burumak trial. Burumak trial is on judicare. Now, the reason for that is financial. We have to look at that. The last aspect is on access, rural areas. We are in the process in the Legal Services Committee to establish a call center. Now, we know that our telecommunication infrastructure has improved quite well. Even a 10-year-old these days carries a cell phone. So if we have a call center, people in rural areas will be in a position at least to be able to get in touch with the nearest office and may be able to get assistance, at least initial assistance, and thus increasing access to that. What we want to say, I think the question was raised on civil legal aid. I think that is one of our challenges which we are working on. We would like to see more people being assisted in terms of our civil legal aid preparedness. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to deal with some of the issues that have been raised. The first one is that one raised by Honourable Spagnoni about whether the legal aid board is a threat to legal practitioners in terms of the cost effectiveness of us doing certain cases on a judicare basis or in-house model. I can tell you, Your Honour, that as I sit here, it is no longer cost-effective, no longer profitable for practitioners in private practice to do district court work. there are those who try and do it, but unless he has a bulk, we see that through the cooperation agreements we strike with attorneys in rural areas. We have to have a certain threshold of cases that he appears in the district court in particular. Otherwise, it doesn't make any commercial sense for them to appear in the district court. You find that our practitioners, if you see in the finalized steps, our practitioners finalize more cases in the district court. And you're looking at more than two or three a day in the district court, right? So it's not that we are making inroads. It's just the reality, commercial reality out there in practice. And we have no control over it. It makes more sense for us, particularly, when we use CAs, because the CA is cheaper to employ, and you get a lot more out of the CA than a qualified attorney who's admitted, because that's more expensive to employ them. But because of the negative media coverage that we've received in the past, that we use raw, green, inexperienced lawyers, we've sort of addressed that part by putting in more admitted attorneys to attend to district court work, right? So it's just to address that. And just to address another general issue that deals with the perception. Most of the criticism against our lawyers was that, and I think it came in the Polsmo context, was that our lawyers only consult just before the case starts in court. Unfortunately, that's a legacy of the judicial system of the past. And I can tell you, I sat as a judge in Johannesburg. When I go on circuit, I knew that no trial will start on the first day of trial because lawyers will come there and say, "Judge, I haven't consulted. Can the matter stand out? I want to go and consult." You find that criticism, if it's still there, it still applies to judicare because for them to leave his office and go and consult with a prisoner out there and come back to his office and do other work, it's a problem. So they would rather go when the trial is about to start and consult on that day and then continue the trial. With our own lawyers, they don't do that because we have what we call a file audit. That's part of our quality assurance measures to check when did you consult? Why did you consult on the day of the court? You know. So you find that most judicial officers prefer our lawyers, our in-house lawyers, to appear in their court. I had a discussion with Mr. Mtimkulu. I think he's the cluster head of the Sterk Spreit and those surrounding areas. And he did say, look, we would prefer to have your lawyers and not the judicial lawyers because sometimes they don't come. When they come, they're not prepared. They waste our time. So I think these are things that we factor into how we do our things. In terms of the substantial injustice question that Honorable Spagnoli raised, I think Patrick answered the question in part, that the means test is not the be and all of the whole thing. Substantial injustice has yet to be defined by the Constitutional Court, but we've defined it on our own as the threat of imprisonment. Right? So once there is that threat of imprisonment and we put the 3-month threshold on it, so once it's there, then the picture changes. So we are always mindful of the substantial injustice part of the Constitution. Just wanted to deal with that. And then regarding the question about whether we collaborate with lawyers' organizations when we've brought down the period within which lawyers wait for their accounts to be paid, we did. I remember when I started as chair, I engaged the lawyers of bodies very vigorously to make sure that their lawyers sent their complaints to them and to me. I can tell you that in the past two financial years, I've received no correspondence from any lawyer complaining that he has not been paid in time, which was a different situation when I took over in 2001, 2002. So we do cooperate. We do have periodic meetings. Twice a year, we meet with the GCB reps. We meet with the LSSA to deal with issues that pertain to the profession that are relevant to us as a legal input. So I think that's just to deal with that part. I think the issue of unfunded mandates, as to what interventions do we take before legislation comes to reality about issues we will be expected to be involved in. We do have a very effective research organization in Mr. Handermark's office. which looks at all these legislation that is planned. And when we see that there's something that may come that may have an expectation on us to field lawyers, we make the necessary approaches early on, right? But we make them through our department, our mother department, the DOJ, to say, look, we see that you are planning 10 courts in that area. Have you factored that into our MTEF allocations and stuff like this? So that proactively, when things happen, we're all ready to run. I think the issue of access to clients in rural areas, I've dealt with it in part, but there was an issue raised. Brian, I don't know if you can respond to this, whether we do use traditional authority offices to consult with people. I would imagine it links to how we send practitioners to advice offices or community organizations. Do we use traditional offices to do this?
Thanks, Judge. In fact, as part of the increasing our access, we want to increasingly link more and more with community facilities, which would include traditional offices also. I can report at the moment that nothing stops us from doing it, but at the moment what I would say is that many of our offices have working relationships with those offices. But what we want to do is actually create a service whereby once a week or once a month our practitioners could be based there to consult with clients. But it's a program that we're developing further this year.
One last comment from me. I think the question was, or the comment was made, that what do we do in terms of making a career in legal aid sexy, if I can use that word, to law students? We have, I think, for the past 3 years now, it may even go further than that, we send in a team to address final year law students to tell them about the Legal Aid Board of South Africa. And I think more in line with what the Legal Resource Center used to do in the past, send people to the universities and people would then find it worth their while to apply and go into a program, then become admitted attorneys. I think it's something that we do. Perhaps we need to do it much more, like the big accounting firms who do it, and that's how they recruit their lawyers. So we do it. Perhaps we'll see how much more we can do to do that. In terms of introducing a subject, I think this would be something very worthwhile, because I've got an 11-year-old daughter, and she tasks me about certain things. She says, "Baba, you say you're a judge. And why did that man who killed this, why did he walk free?" I think it's just basic example. But I'm just saying, if there was a subject that tells students about the legal aid scheme in the country and why it's there, linking it to their constitutional subject, I think it would go a long way into making the organization a career choice for some people. The last issue I want to respond to was government strategic six. I think Honorable Ngengabula raised this. That is not the sixth one from the Legal Aid Board, but that is a government medium-term strategic framework. That's the government medium-term strategic framework number six. So we looked at it. We said, look, in terms of crafting our strategy, we need to remain focused on what the government expects. I hope that answers the question. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Good.
Thank you, Chair. There was a small question of mine that was not answered. I wanted to know what is direct expenditure in relation to other forms of expenditure.
Thank you, Chairperson. Direct expenditure on page 50 of the slide relates to expenditure incurred in the service delivery, direct service delivery, and it comprises of 87 million of that 97 million relates directly to jury care, 4 million relates to impact litigation, while 3.5 million relates to cooperation agreements, expenditure incurred through our cooperation partners, and the balance of 2 million relates to civil disbursements. So it's really expenditure incurred in the direct delivery of services. Thanks.
No, I just want to thank the judge for
interesting about the possibility of availing the document he already expressed, and I'm looking forward to see that. But when you say number six, that could be found in the Treasury documents. The government medium term number six framework. It's in Treasury documents. Okay. Oh, thanks very much.
It's also on the website of government as part of the medium term strategic framework.
Thank you very much. I want to take this opportunity to thank you, Judge, and your team for having walked us through your report. And I think we are the better equipped to understand issues a bit more. Scheduling allowing, we'll possibly have another session to deal with outstanding issues like strategy and so on. So we'll look into that possibility. And I want to take this opportunity to wish you a very pleasant journey from where you came from. Unfortunately, we don't supply lunch. The budget doesn't allow. Thank you very much. The meeting is closed. Thank you.
You know what you need to do is they updated the list.